Good morning. You're listening to The Coffee Table on KBBI AM 890 Homer. Today, we will look at efforts to limit and resist the effects of colonization. Joining us, we have Michael Yellowbird, Director of Indigenous Tribal Studies and Professor of Sociology at North Dakota State University. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
We also have Hannah Gustafson, Coordinator of Mobilizing for Action Through Planning and Partnership, and the leader of the Southern Kenai Peninsula Resilience Coalition. Welcome, Hannah.
Good morning.
And Asia Freeman, the Artistic Director of the Minnell Street Arts Center. Welcome, Asia. I'd like to also invite our listening audience to join in the conversation. If you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. Please give us a call at 907-235-7721, or you can email us at info@kbbi.org. Let's start by talking about colonization. Michael, do you want to say what we mean when we say the word colonization?
Sure. Well, if you're thinking about colonization, you know, that colonization sort of is defined from a number of different fields. If you're talking about, you know, medicine, you see that the body gets colonized by certain kinds of bacteria and viruses and fungi and that kind of thing. And sometimes during the initial colonization of the body by different bacteria or viruses, the person can get really sick, you know, or they could die, you know, from the initial exposure to something that's foreign. Same with people, you know, and same with animals. There are different kinds of invasive species, that whether they're humans or animals, that come into another animal or human territory, and they begin to colonize, they begin to rebuild a place so it supports their who they are and their beliefs and their values and also, you know, biologically, politically, and socially, those kinds of things. So today, if we think about colonization, we go back to that term, that medical term, to understand that, you know, it is an invasion, you know, by something that's foreign. Could be a pathogen, could be a bacteria, could be people that come into another individual's or community's territory, and they begin to sort of upset and change the structures and the functions and the institutions of the people that were there. And many times colonization, most of the time colonization, has very devastating effects on the people that have been living in a particular kind of way for, you know, thousands of years, really, you know, for long periods of time. And so that sort of sets off a whole chain of reactions where we see things that that sort of are sort of the fallout from colonization, where we see higher levels of suicide, higher levels of you know, poor health, higher levels of economic failure, and so on. It's just, so there's a lot of things like that. But simply, you know, it's just when another group invades and subjugates another group, is how you say it simply.
And what do you say to people who, you know, think that this has kind of happened a long time ago and is no longer relevant to us now? How do we still see colonization happening now?
No, it happens all the time. Any time that someone or some group of people go, or even animals or whatever, go into another area where they haven't had their presence, you know, widely distributed before, they can bring things. For example, I'm traveling right now, and any time I get on the airlines, you know, I could travel from, you know, let's say, Chile or something, and travel back to Florida. And I could bring, you know, a bug, you know, like a extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis that doesn't exist right now in like on the mainland of the United States. So anytime we move into another area, we're bringing not only diseases, but we're bringing ideas and values and so on. I used to live in Phoenix, Arizona, or Tempe, Arizona, and when I moved down there, there were a number of invasive species that were in the desert where people had brought, you know, from the Mediterranean or brought from other warm parts of the country and so on. So that's happening. Colonization is happening all the time. You may get a change in government, where you've had a stable, you know, government of a particular state or a municipality or whatever, and they can come in with all these different ideas that, you know, they bring in that are colonizing ideas. They have a tendency to, of course, to uproot the ideas and the belief, for example, that, you know, everyone has the right to free education or something. Then that's the idea that exists, and someone else can come in and sort of begin to colonize and change the value and the belief system around that. So it's just happening all the time, not only by Native and non-Native groups, but it's happening within you know, non-Native groups too as well. You know, this is constant sort of push and pull where colonization is happening.
And Asian, you mentioned the other day ways you see this playing out in Alaska. You know, for example, just the way we talk about, you know, the history of Alaska and sometimes how it's whitewashed. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Well, when I was growing up here in Homer, you know, when we talk about when, you know, sort of the history of Alaska, we really were describing it in terms of statehood. Sometimes we take it back to the Russian conquest. Sometimes we'd take it back to the purchase of Alaska. That's certainly very important and imperative thing to know. But was it imperative to know that Alaska is a state that's belonged to indigenous people for 10,000 years? No, that isn't something that really became at all emphasized, I would say, if at all, till quite lately. So it's been something I see in my life really changing, this acknowledgement of the land, who it belongs to, and reconsideration of how we understand the, quote, facts from a white perspective.
And Michael, I know you've also talked about climate change, you know, in terms of colonization. You know, can you expand on how we can look at, for instance, climate change as a way of, you know, who's benefiting from what and who's sort of being exploited? Oh, Michael, are you still there? And it looks like we actually are having a little bit of technical difficulty of getting Michael on the line. So we'll wait till he gets back. You know, and while we wait, Hannah, do you want to talk about, you know, in the fields of work that you're in and, you know, social justice and activism and health, the conversations that you're seeing happening about colonization?
Definitely. So as the MAP coordinator, I had the opportunity to travel up to Anchorage a few months ago for a prevention conference, and there was a whole day dedicated to a workshop on decolonization, and that's kind of where this idea kind of rooted in the importance of this conversation here locally and the work that we're doing, because we are spending a lot of time through our Resilience Coalition working to support, you know, the well-being of families and children within our community, and, you know, understanding the big picture. You know, nothing happens in isolation. All of these systems are interrelated. You know, understanding how history has affected individuals and communities is a really important piece of this work. And yes, so I was really excited to have kind of this, my experience and the work that I'm doing with the Resilience Coalition intersect with what Asia has been doing there with Bunnell Street Arts Center and their look at colonization over the last few years, and to see, you know, as a community, how do we explore this topic and dig a little deeper in the work that we're doing to try and improve the lives for everyone here. So.
And you've talked about, you know, how history has impacted communities and peoples here. Can you give sort of specific examples in terms of, you know, what those conversations have focused on? And, you know, in Alaska, how has the history, you know, impacted peoples here, and, you know, specifically Indigenous peoples?
Yes. So there was a study done called the ACE study. It was Adverse Childhood Experiences that really brought the science together in public health, showing how so many of the public health issues we face as a society, whether it be obesity or diabetes, cancer, some of the social issues of substance abuse and suicides and poverty, how so many of these things can be rooted back to early childhood experiences, and how trauma really has an effect on the developing brain and can make people more susceptible to challenges further down the line. The beauty is, though, that there's also this opportunity for healing. So knowing the ability of the brain to heal and for societies to heal through things like mindfulness and really proactive measures, we're working with the Alaska Resilience Initiative, which is a statewide group, to bring a curriculum called History and Hope through to the community and throughout Alaska, and it's Adverse Childhood Experiences, Resilience, and Trauma-Informed Care. And it's an Alaskan-based curriculum that really brings in some components that we have not had in curriculums before, such as Alaska Native ancestral knowledge of trauma and resilience. It also, I think, a really important part of this education, as people get exposed to these ideas and understanding, is realizing that it can be traumatizing to learn about the effects of trauma. So part of this curriculum, and part of when we present this information, has an integration of simple brain body healing exercises. So throughout the curriculum, we take a moment to take a break and to recenter and to really get grounded as we go through this really deep, heavy, important information. So
yeah, and you touched on this a little bit, but why, you know, what is the impact of even, you know, possibly not knowing your history?
Well, I think stories are really powerful, and that's we all have a story as individuals, as communities, and the ability to tell your story and to own your story and tell your truth is an important piece of being human, and I think an important step in where healing can occur, both within individuals and communities.
And I want to bring Michael back into the conversation. It seems like we may have lost him. Let's take a little break, and we'll try to get him back on the line and continue our conversation. Back with the coffee table. Today we are looking at efforts to limit and resist the effects of colonization, and we got Michael back on the line. Let's, you know, we were just talking about, you know, what happens when you, you know, lose your stories and your history. Michael, can you also talk about, have you seen in terms of effects of colonization, loss of traditions, and what impact that has?
Yeah, I think it's pretty evident. I think that the effects that colonization have on people's traditions, the loss of culture, and you know, anything that people use that they've been practicing for a long time is not only like a social loss, but also people experience a loss all the way down to molecular level. And what I mean by that is that, for example, if you've had in a village, or if you've had in a community or society, any society, methods for dealing with, let's say, violence, for example. And you've had traditional methods of dealing with violence and preventing violence from a very early age. If you lose those traditions, or if you lose that ability to even adjudicate, you know, some of your own cases in your community, if someone comes in and says, you know, you people don't know what you're doing, you have to do it our way, instead of peacemaking between families, for example, in traditional culture and villages and that sort of thing, someone comes in and you have a form of justice where it's you know, this confrontation between people, and it's very like dispute oriented rather than peacemaking. That happens a lot, even in U.S. law. I mean, So what happens is that people go, you know, they commit a crime of violence. They go to, they go into, you know, to have their case heard, and then they, let's say they do their time, they do a period of time in jail. They're released, they come back into the community. There's really no way to bring people back in the community to prevent them from reoffending. And that happens not only in Native communities, it happens a lot in non-Native communities, because there's not a traditional way to to bring these people back in the community. And that happens over and over again. I see that over and over again. You know, people who are committed crimes against children, they are you know, brought back into a community, and they reoffend again. There's no mechanism for that. So tribal cultures have had, not only, you know, in the U.S., but around the world, have had mechanisms for that. So that, you know, first they work to prevent it at a very early age. You know, there's those kinds of things that go on, those kinds of systems that are in place. But if someone does offend in a tribal community or an indigenous community, then there are all these ways to bring the person back in the community so they don't reoffend. That's kind of just one example. There are many examples of how, when traditions are lost, how it can have this sort of direct impact on a community. And people can look at that community and then they will just, you know, and, you know, say, well, they committed a lot of crimes, or that's the kind of people they are, or whatever. But, you know, people have been doing this for such a long period of time that, you know, we could look at a number of slides or look at the research to show that, you know, people have actually have genetic markers to pursue these different kinds of things, you know, to resolve, you know, crimes, or to have conversations, or to do community work together to deal with those kinds of things. And this is just one example. There are many, many examples.
And you said they have genetic markers to deal with these kind of things? You mean like they're, you know, working within their own system to deal with this?
Yeah. Well, for example, there's a gene variant called a serotonin gene transporter. You know, it's labeled as a 5-H TTLRP, and that's the you know, where the location of the gene is, but they, for short, they call it the serotonin transporter gene. We know from a lot of cultural research, cultural neuroscience studies, that there are frequencies in certain populations that are very collectivist populations, let's say Aboriginal people and Indigenous people and Native people. You'll find that those people have this particular genetic marker, and a lot of studies have been done by a professor by the name of Joan Chiao, who was, I think she's at Chicago, she was at Northwestern University, who did this global study of this gene where it occurred. And what she found was that the people who had a high frequency of this gene were very collectivist people. They weren't individualistic people. Now, differences are like this. So these people have a collectivist genetic predisposition to work together, to be collective together, to, you know, heal together, to cooperate, you know, and that, you know, particular genetic profile then is really sort of calmed down. It's not expressed. It's not expressed when people are cooperating. Now, the other thing that happens is if they're not cooperating, they're isolated, they're living in cities, they're not working together and that kind of thing, that gene can be expressed. And when it's expressed, what happens is that you have higher levels of anxiety disorders, higher levels of depression, higher levels of alcoholism, higher levels of suicide, all those kinds of things, because the group is really the protective factor in all of this. So if you have a society that moves in, that colonizes you and tells you that, you know, individualism, you know, is the highest, you know, marker of civilization, you know, then you got to watch out, because that's what's been happening for a long time in indigenous communities. And many indigenous communities have for long periods of time tried to avoid having that kind of change in their cultures, because intuitively they knew that from a genetic molecular level they didn't know that, because we didn't have the technology to look at that. So we actually have these very key critical genetic differences between cultures. Now, this doesn't mean that non-Native cultures or non-Indigenous cultures don't have this particular marker. They do, but it's less frequent. So you're going to see that people that, you know, have, let's see, from, let's say, Western European or certain kinds of backgrounds that end up, you know, somewhere else, they bring that colonization to that area. Let's say someone ended up in Alaska, for instance, and became, you know, a high, you know, political official, and there was a group of them, and they decided that, you know, it was good that everybody was individuals here and they shouldn't be, you know, work together anymore, because that's, you know, how we did it in another part of the world. But, you know, it could be that their individualistic genetic profile variants are driving them toward that. And if they can take control and colonize, then that becomes sort of the widespread sort of belief and theory. So there's it's gone way, way beyond now our understanding of colonization, you know, just as a form of oppression. We know that it affects people at a molecular and genetic levels as well. And there are many, many other ways. These are the things that I've been studying for the last several years and writing and working on now. I mean, even the foods we eat, you know, the religions we practice, the gods that we believe in, and those kinds of things are very, very different for some reason. But they have very, very different kinds of markers in our brains and in our genetics and in our molecular systems that either support well-being or they support, you know, fear and anxiety and those kinds of things.
Wow, and that's so fascinating that you can see that on that level. And, you know, I want to move to talking about how Indigenous people are working through this in terms of art. Asia, how have you seen, you know, Bunnell Street Arts Center has been exhibiting a lot of art from Indigenous people tackling decolonization. What have you seen as the issues and the topics that people are looking at and the art that they're making this about?
Yes, so for many years, through primarily through solo and group shows, I started to see themes emerge around identity construction, efforts to understand what is my story through artwork, and efforts to tell a story that has to do with healing. Healing may relate to the body and diet, the effects of colonization on the diet. For example, Lena Amison and Melissa Shaganoff are two different Indigenous artists from this region of Alaska who have been dealing with things like juvenile diabetes or other autoimmune disorders that are caused by a colonial diet. And in reclaiming the Indigenous diet, they've discovered health, but the work is the way in which the story may be told. So Melissa Shaganoff created a beautiful painted, beaded self-portrait in which a small caribou antler and a tiny vial and a beaded syringe are hanging around her neck as a kind of emblem of identity. And she talks about how normally, with her maturity, with her first menstruation, an Atna Athabascan woman, which is her background, would receive a swan wing bone as a symbol of her maturity. She would drink water through this wing bone. It would separate and distinguish her power. At that very age, Melissa discovered that she, as had many members of her family, contracted juvenile diabetes. And so she received the insulin and you know, kit. And it's a powerful story about a shift in, you know, the effects of colonization on her diet, quite simply, but also the way in which through her art she's able to tell her story, create an extraordinary personal and beautiful object, but something to which a lot of people could actually relate. And then you discover that that's quite prevalent, but how are people telling their stories? She's doing it in a really unique way. A few years back, Drew Michael had an exhibit in which he created some really large-scale masks, and one particularly powerful one that's about 30 inches tall and about 24 inches wide called What's My Story, this carved basswood mask that's embellished with feathers and these chains, appendages that hang around the eye. On one hand look like these extraordinary, beautiful, long lashes or something. But in the other way, you see this man looking through kind of a lens that has to do with some kind of constraint or pain or weight, you know. And it turns out, you know, he's Yupik and Inupiaq. He was adopted as a young age, at a young age. And so he's been searching for his story. And how he's been able to explore and tell it has been largely through art. His parents were thoughtful enough to enroll him early on in a lot of different carving and mask making classes with different Indigenous teachers in the Anchorage area where he was raised. And so he's created these pieces that evoke his story.
And what have you seen as the impact for artists who have done this? What's it been, you know, what have you heard from them about what it's been like to do this and what sort of effect it's had on them to make this art?
Well, I feel like especially the ones who I've spoken of are just really, you know, soaring upward. Melissa just opened a big solo show in British Columbia, and Drew is, you know, getting all over the world. But I also have thought about how it's particularly powerful, how indigenous technologies, ways of making things, using things like fish skin and wood, are inspiring non-Native artists to share their concerns about the effects of colonization in Alaska, specifically looking at things like fishing, like industrial fishing, deep sea trawling versus little mom and pop fishing at the scale that, say, Annette Bellamy does it with Marvin for nearly 40 years. So she, you know, she, like many kids, was raised with little fish fingers, fish sticks, you know, from ocean caught pollock or what have you. And in her piece called Fish Fingers, she creates this beautiful round circular wall-mounted sculpture in which each digit, finger-sized digit molded off her own hand, is made from the skins of the fish from her own meal, saved and sewn and mounted. So it's a kind of far out, like slightly fetishistic looking sculpture, but it's extremely beautiful because she's talking about like one boat at a time, one meal at a time. Do we live sustainably? Are we protecting our fisheries? So that cause, you know, is shared by many people, and people who've come to Alaska to enjoy life ways that are inspired by Indigenous people are interested in sustainability. And art can be a way of talking about it that brings more people into the discussion.
And have you seen these pieces start conversations and community members talk about what they see there?
Well, sure. You know, in mostly in the context of a museum or a gallery exhibit. But what I'm excited about now is that we have a resilience coalition in Homer, you know, and we have a lot of different groups and a beautiful array of partners in bringing Dr. Yellowbird here, for example, who want to think about and discuss decolonization from more of a systemic perspective, right? So you have like Haven House and Cook Inlet Keeper. Our major sponsor is Homer Foundation. You have the Methodist Church and, my goodness, you have, that's us, MAP. You know, Hannah, who heard about Dr. Yellowbird coming to Fairbanks and said, let's broaden this conversation. And because we're all interested in thinking about how we can reduce the manifold systemic effects of colonization that just even continue today in how we relate to each other and how we care for our bodies and our communities. And we can express that, yes, through art, but conversation and training is really a critical part of that.
And Michael, I want to go back to you. You know, Asia mentioned decolonization. I'm wondering if you can kind of start by talking about, you know, what it means when, you know, we talked about colonization, but what do we mean when we say decolonization? And we seem to have lost Michael again. Let's take another quick break and we'll get him back right on the show. All right, stay with us.
Hello?
Michael, you're here. Sorry, we thought we lost you for a second. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Yes, yeah. Can you hear it? Great. You know, so Michael, I was just saying Asia was talking about decolonization. You know, we chatted at the beginning about colonization. What does it mean to decolonize?
I started saying, you know what, I just realized I had my mute on, but in order to decolonize, I think one has to really understand the science of colonization, right? First of all, I mentioned that, you know, it's really about like this forced entry, this invasion of your personal space, your gendered space, or your cultural space, right? And then, yeah, what level have those been manipulated? how are your values, beliefs, and traditions been manipulated? That's kind of the science of colonization. And what in another part of it is control. Besides manipulation, there's control of your thinking, your behaviors, and your knowledge. So it's getting a little more complex. And finally, the last thing is domination. What are the imposed rules, policies, and social standing that you have as a people, or as you know, a person of color or a woman or whatever? So the science of colonization has four pieces: invasion, manipulation, control, and domination. So in order to get to decolonization, you have to understand, you know, at what level has invasion and subjugation, things like genocide, loss of culture, ceremony, your rights, loss of territory and resources, and your manipulation, you know, at what level has that occurred? And I think that's some of the work we need to do now is we do some statistical work on that. We see that, and we make some assumptions that everyone's been colonized to this level, but they haven't. There's a lot of resilient people out there with a lot of resilient genetics and a lot of resilient, you know, thinking and behavior. So part of the colonization then is understanding that and the oppressions that go with it. You know, how much racism, how many stereotyping, how's that going on? What level of poverty and marginalization, you know, are people experiencing? And one of the things that I work on with a number of folks is looking at things like murdered and missing indigenous women, you know, which is pretty big. And so we know that, you know, we can talk about stereotypes and racism and look at figures there. Then we can come to even more contemporary things like, you know, what needs to be colonized is the thinking around, you know, murdered and missing indigenous women. And then there are all the other disparities, life expectancy, chronic diseases you've been talking about, like diabetes, mental health, you know, disorders like depression and anxiety, suicide, those kinds of things, drug use. So what is decolonization then? Understanding all of that and understanding that decolonization is understanding that colonization is traumatic, it's invasive, it's generational, it infects indigenous people at an historical, social, and even at molecular, cellular levels. So understanding and eradicating colonization, you know, very simply, the theory is it's going to create greater well-being among indigenous peoples. The other part of decolonization, then, is decolonization practice or approaches. That means privileging and engaging in indigenous philosophies, things, the beliefs, the practices. We were just talking about art, for example, and changing diet. Those are all those kinds of things, and values that counter colonialism and restore well-being. So those values could be the values for well-being and happiness, for healthy, you know, bodies and healthy minds, those kinds of things. What kinds of practices then that does one engage in then to lift that those colonizations that have been sort of, you know, kind of holding people prisoner for a long time? So that's what decolonization means. And really, the final thing that I've written some about is there's a process to it. It's stripping away these harmful, invasive thoughts, because decolonization really is about, you know, I'm thinking I'm colonized. You know, people tell you you're colonized or you're oppressed. And you have to strip away these harmful, invasive thoughts, practices, and beliefs that have been imposed by these colonizing structures and restore the cultural practices, thinking, beliefs, and values that were taken away or abandoned during colonization, but they're still relevant and necessary for today. The final part of the decolonization process that I've written about is birthing new ideas and using new technologies and thinking and lifestyles that contribute to the advancement and empowerment of indigenous people. So stripping away harmful, invasive thoughts, restoration of cultural practices, and birthing, you know, new ideas. There's the idea that we talk about a lot, that there was the other world of our ancestors that had all these good things happening and maybe some things that were challenging. Those fell and they were born into this world, and that's the colonization. Decolonization is making this world and all of its parts that are really, really damaging and harmful to us die and to arise into a new world of life. That's kind of how the process works.
Right. And I know you've talked about, too, you know, starting with decolonization of the mind. Can you talk about the use of mindfulness practices in decolonization?
Sure. Well, what I call it is neural decolonization and the act of willful neuroplasticity, like, you know, which means neural decolonization is this, first I'll deal with that. Term neuro refers to the neurons that are specialized cells in our brains and our nervous system, our spinal cord, and that's happening to us all right now. If people are listening to the thing, as you're moving around, as you're thinking and glancing at things, electrical signals are moving throughout your body and throughout your brain and spinal cord. So that's the first part, neuro. Decolonization then refers to those activities that weaken the effects of colonialism, facilitate resistance, create opportunities, promote traditional practices in everyday life. And really what that is about relearning traditional, you know, practices, languages, ways of living, and that sort of thing. So neurodecolonization then puts those two words together, and what it does is it involves combining mindfulness practices with traditional and contemporary contemplative practices to re-sculpt these neural pathways in the brain that are negative patterns of thought, emotion, and behavior. Because we know from all of the research around neuroplasticity, when we've had been living in a very negative, marginalized, oppressive, and system with scarce resources, we know that we begin to develop these neural pathways. We actually develop neural connections that, you know, support and facilitate negativity, low levels of optimism and that sort of thing. But we know that when we begin to think positive, we begin to do positive practices, and we do that for long periods of time, very consistently, we begin to eliminate these problematic neural networks and replace them with healthy, productive ones. And that you can actually see when you do brain imaging for people who are doing mindfulness meditation practices or contemplative practices. Anything can be, these are examples of how you can change those neural networks. Exercise, running, intermittent fasting, as I talk about that a lot, sleeping well, doing meditation, collectivism, hanging out with other people like you, and doing a lot of laughing. Those kinds of things really seem to kind of begin to reshape the brain in many, many important ways.
And do you have stories of this, of indigenous people that you've worked with in terms of mindfulness and bringing back those practices that you could share with us, some specific stories of people you've seen, you know, really helped by this?
Well, that's one of the things. I think that it's fairly new, and I think that we haven't known a lot about it until very recently, because, what people have done for a long period of time, what their ancestors have done, what their cultures have done, has been dismissed as, primitive or backward, or, there's really nothing, no value in it whatsoever, So now, as we go back and begin to look at, what indigenous people did, for example, we know that collectivist, cultures, when people are together and laughing, they begin to, have this expression of this particular gene I mentioned before, the serotonin transporter gene. In most of the therapies we use today, they're Western therapies, they're talk therapies and that sort of thing. We don't really use a collectivist full village sort of model. And we don't say, well, you need to laugh, because we didn't understand laughter until very recently in humor. What it does to our neural networks, what it does to neutralizing things. If we've inherited particular genes that, there's a gene called ADRA2B, A-D-R-A, B, ADRA2B, which is a particular gene that's found throughout societies, and some societies have higher levels of it. What it does is it makes a person have a higher level of emotionally enhanced vividness. So they experience trauma, historical trauma. They experience violence in a more enhanced way, and maybe that's why these are the people that are more likely to succumb and have very difficult times sort of eliminating trauma or historical trauma, those kinds of things. These are things that most therapists and people don't know, because you have to be able to go across the disciplines like I was trained to do, to go across and borrow from molecular, genetics or sciences or from neurosciences and bring that in and look at indigenous people, because most of the models that were developed for indigenous people were deficit models. They had to be, to do what non-indigenous people do in order to be civilized. Now we know that, that was really, really grossly wrong and very, very harmful. So now we know that in epigenetic inheritance then that happens, to people when you get things like diabetes or you get, cancers or heart disease, those kinds of things, are not only, related to diet, but they're also related to the different kinds of genetic talk that are going on in the epigenetic world inside of us, where someone maybe had, our ancestors had these very very traumatic experiences, and we're passing down these epigenetic markers, and they end up in later generations, and we may or may not know why this is happening. But now we've got enough science to know that one of the things that what people can do, you're asking what people who do this, this kind of thing. But what we want to do now is begin to examine that and to get people in therapy, get people in human, who are doing human service work, counseling, those kinds of things, to begin to pursue some other models, and then to take other measures, to kind of figure out whether or not if people are in this collectivist, situation, and if they do have markers for this EEV, this emotionally enhanced vividness, from this particular gene, does this collective hanging out and laughter, is this more healing than, talk therapy or medication or those kinds of things? My hypothesis, of course, it is, because I think we have these markers, and now we're getting, the approach to counseling, the approach to therapy has been very primitive, in my opinion, without considering these other molecular and cellular and processes and how it, really sort of connects to culture. And that's kind of what neurodecolonization is about, is kind of understanding. What I've done is I put together a new medicine wheel, is to understand the mind in terms of our neurogenesis and our neuroplasticity and what happens to the brain under different kinds of stresses and traumas and what the resilient brain is all about, because I've done enough research around there to kind of know that, there's a resilient brain, and there's also a resilient part of our brain called the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, VMPFC. So I've been studying that, but we don't know until we begin to sit down and do a lot more investigation. There's also another part that the other caller was talking about the diet. We know that one of the things that's so important now to well-being is the human microbiome. And if people eat a particular kind of fiber or have a certain kind of plant-based diet or have a certain kind of protein diet that they've been doing for a long time, it does go on to support the microbiota that live in our guts. And, those kinds of, I call it the new great circle of life. It has these conversations with our brain, rest of our body, and sends out signals of wellness or, thrive or decay kind of signals. So that's really, big in the study. So the other part of the medicine, I'll finish quickly here because I know I'm taking a lot of time, is the spirit part. And that's where the contemplative practices come in, with a lot of Native people do that contemplative practice. The final piece is the emotions, and that's what I'm talking about in terms of the genetic inheritance and things like telomeres, which are molecular structures at the end of chromosomes that we know now that people who are very stressed and have chronic stress in their life have shorter telomeres, which is not a good thing because it increases the diseases of aging, and you can even find those in children. So we've been doing all this kind of work with indigenous populations without knowing all these other markers, and we know that this is why people did what they did in terms of their how they ate, how they thought, the contemplative practices that they had, and the practices they had for healthy communities and that sort of thing.
And are there challenges to getting those practices, to reintegrating those practices? For instance, do people feel at times hopeless or don't want to kind of incorporate back into those things? Or, in terms of diet, making sure that people do have access to the sort of old diet that they used to have?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's difficult now. I mean, I'm sitting at an airport now, and, every third person that walks by is, drinking a sweet drink and carrying, rolls and stuff, and of course, they're obviously, obese, and that's the kind of, it's not only affecting indigenous people, I mean, it's affecting a lot of people, So, and this is what we're dealing with, trying to create and some awareness and understanding of the importance of a healthy diet, the right amount of fiber, how to feed the great circle of life inside your gut, and dealing with, pizza and wings I'm looking at right now, and all these other things that people eat. So, yeah, it is difficult because, to get into it really deeply is to get really deeply into the discussion of how these systems work together. But yeah, it is difficult. But I think there are ways that practices, that mindfulness practices that people can do that people have always done, in these communities, and six mindfulness practices that can improve the emotions, reset our genetic expression, and facilitate improved learning, for example. Very simple. Running and exercise, getting the right amount of sleep, laughing, good sense of humor, collectivism, being around other people that are positive, intermittently fasting and eating right, and also doing contemplative practices like meditation. There's only six things that seem, probably more than that, but these are things that I've investigated and found a lot of really good evidence base for these things. That's not something, if you went to go see the doctor and says, well, you know, I'm not feeling well, you need to laugh more, you need to sleep better, you need to go for a run every day, you need to hang out with your friend, and you know what, you need to fast more, and you need to meditate, right? But, Western medicine doesn't do that kind of thing. Their prescription is a drug, some kind of pharmaceutical drug that creates all kinds of other issues and side effects.
And Hannah, MAMP is looking into taking some of Michael's work and developing with health professionals. And can you talk about that? What's sort of next in incorporating Michael's work into what we're seeing here in Homer?
Definitely. So we are bringing Michael here to the community, and we'll have a talk this evening, which is open to the public and everyone to join at 6 p.m. at the Homer United Methodist Church. And then tomorrow morning we have a workshop where also open to community members, and we'll dig a little deeper into this. And he spoke about this model of this integrated medicine wheel that he's been working with. And with MAP, we look at eight dimensions of wellness. So it's a similar circle and interconnectedness between all these different systems, but it's a little more than the four he speaks about. We're looking at, with these eight dimensions of wellness, cultural wellness, economic wellness, educational wellness, emotional wellness, environmental wellness, physical wellness, social wellness, and spiritual wellness. So there's a little bit of overlap, but still this idea that these systems are integrated and interconnected, and struggle in one area affects the others, and then also intention and healing and energy into an area that may be at a deficit is going to ultimately benefit the others as well. So yeah, I think there's an opportunity through the work of MAP to dig a little deeper with this wellness perspective, and both this evening with our public gathering and then tomorrow with the workshop as well. So, and there's more information on both of those opportunities on our website, which is mapp.net. So mapposkp.net.
In Asia, are there things in the future with Bunnell Street Arts Center and the topic of decolonization?
Absolutely. You know, we're just engaged in a multi-year, perhaps it'll be, an ongoing project to look at the effects of colonization through the lens of art. So we've had a national touring exhibit just ended, went all the way out to Washington, D.C., to the Corcoran School of Art and to some community discussions surrounding the themes of colonization. Then subsequently, we brought Alushka, Alaska, you know, the play to the Mariner Theater, which is probably why Hannah Gustafson knew that we'd be interested in supporting another level of talk and discussion to look at the systemic effects of colonization. We'll continue to do that through you will see it coming up through our solo exhibit series, especially for Indigenous artists. And it's not limited to, you know, the conversation is very much open, because I think we all have a part in it, you know, in either participating or resisting, you know, the effects of colonization. And it can happen across all different kinds of media. It's really perhaps the first time it came to my attention was Emily Johnson. She's a Yupik, Alaskan mixed background, European background as well. But she's from the Soldotna area, and she came home to do a project here. We've supported her over 10 years and three different projects in a trilogy that explores her roots through land acknowledgement and storytelling and dance. So that, as you hear about land acknowledgement, as you hear about storytelling and the healing power of story, of writing one's own story and reflecting the adaptation and resilience that's actually characterized the survival of Indigenous people for tens of thousands of years, and today we can, you know, celebrate power and truth and healing at the same time.
And Michael, and in your travels and in your work, what's sort of giving you, if anything, you know, hope when we talk about decolonization? I know that, you know, colonization can be a really tough subject to talk about and to think about, and you know, of course, for those experiencing it, are there things that are sort of giving you hope in terms of handling it and in terms of decolonization?
Yeah, I think one of the things is that, you know, like having the three of us on your show right now, I'm so interested and glad to hear what folks are doing, and so the movement is occurring. You know, I mean, it's occurring. I think it's you've got, you know, really smart, intelligent, you know, engaged folks like your other two guests are, and then the people they work with. I think that really gives me a lot of hope. But I do see. I think a whole movement kind of happening. That really is, I think, important to pay attention to, because now, you know, I think in the our world of art, like you're talking about, or in the world of food and nutrition, the world of health, all these different kinds of things, you know, are really, really getting a lot of attention in terms of how to decolonize these particular areas. And even to bring up the word decolonization, I think is a very powerful sort of act, you know, because it's like, it's talking about resistance, and it's talking about, you know, something's not right. Something has to change. And, you know, people are, you know, we've got these folks that are out there doing this great work. So I'm you know, very, I get invited to go all over the world to talk about this stuff, and I know people are very interested in it. I've published a lot on this, written books on this sort of thing, and they're very well received. So I'm really glad to see, you know, this kind of movement happening. And I think it's going to get stronger and stronger as we continue to see more and more big changes happening in the world, on the planet. And most of us that, you know, on an everyday sort of thing, we can see the ice shrinking. We can see, you know, the oceans warming. We can see, you know, how people are being displaced, you know, here and there, and, you know, without, you know, by the current systems that are failing right now. We're into this place, you know, where we're kind of in, you know, decay, kind of in a decay mode right now in the Western world. So I think the people see that quite a bit.
Well, Michael, we're very excited to have you in Homer this week, and thank you so much for coming on our show.
Well, I appreciate the being able to be on your show, and I want to thank the other guests, because when I wasn't cut off and the line wasn't dropped, I really enjoyed hearing that they had the same great work that they're doing. So thank you both, and thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. I also want to thank Asia and also Hannah for coming to talk with us, and thanks to our listening audience to tuning in. This has been The Coffee Table, and you're listening to KBBI Homer AM 890.